Last week was an epic week for astronomers, mathematicians and astrophysicists around the world with the capturing of the first picture of a black hole in this galaxy. The picture shows a halo of dust and gas tracing the outline of a colossal black hole at the heart of the Messier 87 galaxy, 55 million light years from Earth. Known as Sagittarius Star A, I think it's Sag A star they call it, the object is a staggering 4 million times the mass of our sun. It was a particular thrill for the University of Canterbury's distinguished Professor Roy Kerr, as it proved his theory, posited more than 50 years ago, when he found the exact solution of Albert Einstein's equations that describe rotating black holes. I think he may have spoken with Kim Hill on Saturday, actually. Dr. Kerr's colleague and University of Canterbury Professor of Physics is David Wiltshire, and he says it's an incredibly exciting development. You can see the image on our webpage if you haven't seen it already. Professor Wiltshire, kia ora, and welcome to 9 to Noon.
Morena, Catherine.
Are you a Wiltshire?
Just one little correction to what you said. The Messier 87 galaxy is actually one which is, that's not our galaxy, that's the black hole that we saw, which was announced a few years ago.
Oh, I see.
There are differences between that black hole and this black hole. This black hole is very firmly in the middle of our galaxy.
That's the surprise, actually. You were looking for one and you found the other, I think. That's the story we'll pick up on. We'll get that corrected. Thank you. You'll probably be correcting me all through the interview, I imagine.
That's okay.
No, it's fine. And I want to know whether you're a Wiltshire or a Wiltshire, more importantly.
Wiltshire or Wiltshire, I don't mind.
People never mind. Can you explain also, and I will ask questions and correct me and don't be ashamed of doing so or embarrassed about doing so, you can't actually see a black hole. Isn't that kind of the point? What you can see is the evidence of it through the absence of something, correct?
Indeed, but what you can see is the stuff that's falling in, if there's enough of the stuff falling in. So our own galaxy is littered with black holes, hundreds of, well, millions, zillions of black holes, which are the normal or garden variety black holes, and we never detect those except unless there happen to be two of them that get together and form a bigger black hole and give off gravitational waves. So those ones, the garden variety ones, we can't actually see. But when such black holes get together in the dense parts in the middle of galaxies, then they merge and then they create gigantic supermassive black holes. So that's not your garden variety, but the one in the middle of our galaxy or in the middle of any other galaxy. Indeed, the one in Messier 87, M87, is 1,600 times more massive than the one that's in our own galaxy. But those ones we can detect through the accretion of material onto the black hole. So what you actually see in the image is the accretion disk. And sometimes when there is enough stuff falling in, then we get these huge jets. Now, those jets are present in M87. It's accreting matter at a greater rate, but not in our own galaxy. Our own galaxy, it's relatively quiet. It would have been active long time ago when the universe first soon after the Big Bang, when all the first stars formed, then there was a lot of gas around. And so there was a lot of stuff for black holes in the centers of galaxies to eat. And so our own galaxy would have been having these jets as well.
So what is it that we are looking at in the case of the one in our galaxy? What do you describe to people as what they're seeing?
Right. So it is turbulent. Well, actually, it's bigger than turbulent. It's like a tornado of particles, which are a gas, but technically it's a plasma. That's to say, they aren't atoms. All the electrons and nuclei have been stripped apart. They're whizzing around at a huge fraction of the speed of light, and it's like a gigantic tornado. So to continue the theme of your earlier, and what we are learning to understand is the difference between accretion disks with small tornadoes, which in this case would be the size of the orbit of the moon, as opposed to a huge, large tornado. And what appears to be the case here is that we've got this huge, large tornado, which is sort of about the size of the orbit of Mercury, because this black hole, the 4.1 million solar masses, you could fit, it would fit in about one third of the orbit of Mercury if you put it in our own solar system. And from there, sort of out to the orbit of Mercury is this mass, this huge disk of these charged particles whizzing around and making magnetic fields. And that's what we're learning about.
Now, the black hole, matter's collapsing in on itself, essentially. The gravitational is so strong that nothing can get out. I'm not sure about the jets you were referring to earlier. You can pick up on that. But again, as a
Indeed.
Phenomena, what is it?
So a black hole is something which has collapsed in on itself. So at the end of the lifetime of a star is held up by burning, so the pressure of burning. Once it's burnt all its fuel, then it'll undergo some explosion, and dead stars will then go into three possibilities. A white dwarf, if there's not much mass that's left over after the explosion, our own sun will become a white dwarf. It's still, it'll be very dense, and that's when there is another sort of pressure that comes from quantum physics and electromagnetism. All the electrons are forced into their ground states, so there is a pressure we call electron degeneracy pressure, and that will keep a white dwarf from further collapse. If there's more mass left over from the explosion, because you started with a bigger star originally, then that pressure force is beaten because gravity wins out. If you've got enough density of matter, the gravity will always win out. But so there's another state where all the electrons are squashed into the nuclei, and then it's a degeneracy pressure from nuclear physics and quantum mechanics, which holds things up. But if the star that you end up with after the collapse is humongously bigger still, then nothing wins, and you'll form a black hole, that's to say something which is so dense that not even light can escape. So it's really a collapsed star, or once you get black holes and merge them, then the result of many collapsed stars, and indeed when you have ones in the middle of galaxies, they're also, especially when the universe is young, they're feeding on all the gas that is nearby, and then you get strong magnetic fields outside, and strong magnetic fields will actually funnel particles away from the black hole. So it's like a messy eater. If you've had toddlers, you know that when they're learning to eat, they will. It doesn't always, not all the stuff goes in. Much of it is flung off. And in this case, a black hole is a very messy eater, and the stuff that's being flung off is being funneled by magnetic fields.
Let's talk about the achievement of the image. Now, it's the second one. So let's get straight what M87 was, Messier 87. And that was in 2019 that image was captured and released. What, however, is the achievement, the particular achievement of this latest one? Well, apart from the fact, of course, scientifically, the interest that it's in our own galaxy, was it also a superior image?
It was actually it is telling us a lot that we didn't know. Of course, it's our black hole, and it's telling us about a black hole which is not as energetic as the one in M87. That one is 1,600 times bigger. It's, 6.5 billion solar masses. And because it's so much bigger, the time that it takes for things to orbit around the black hole, and that black hole is sort of, it would encompass our whole solar system. It's four times, its diameter is four times that of the orbit of Neptune. So in that case, we're seeing a black hole which is very easy to image, because the time that these radio observations are done, and it's using telescopes all over the Earth to sort of use the Earth as a big telescope. And so it's like you've got radio telescope glasses the size of the Earth, just made out of a few telescopes in different places. But they typically observe things for about 8 hours. And if you're looking at M87, then the plasma that is circling around will change over periods of days. And so you've got quite an easy thing to image. It's about the same angular size on the sky, just because it's bigger, but it's much further away. So the two images are in similar size for the telescope, which is why we saw M87. It happens to be about the size that we can image, that people were trying to achieve with the Event Horizon Telescope, because they were interested in seeing the one in the middle of our galaxy. But so the one in our galaxy is telling us a lot more about what is going on in I guess many galaxies which are no longer very active, no longer having so much matter being sucked in that you have these jets, which is the case in the M87.
Just as a final explanation before we get into the physics that's going to come from this, the astrophysics that's going to come from this, and the wonderful science that's going to be done. Are we not seeing an image as if it were shot through an iPhone, right, or taken through a camera? It's the construction of an image using all this data, all this information, to accurately construct what it would look like if you could see it through a camera lens.
Indeed, but just because the time, it's like taking a long exposure shot if you're taking a long exposure of a waterfall, the details will be blurred out, and by necessity, the details are blurred out in this case. And so the reconstruction is quite a problem. So one of the engineers who worked on the project, Katie Bauman, said it's like trying to guess a song played on a piano that's missing keys of the piano. And then also when the tune itself is changing the key that it's played in as you're making the image. So it's a real hard job of reconstructing, which is why it took 5 years to get this image. And that reconstruction also involves simulating how the matter is flowing. And those simulations then tell us what sort of disk we're looking at. In this case, it goes under the name of MAD, a magnetically arrested disk, as opposed to the same models, which are stable in normal evolution. So that is a big thing that we've learned.
Our guest is University of Canterbury Professor of Physics, David Wiltshire. We are talking about the significance of this epic achievement, capturing the first picture, or image is a better word, of a black hole in this galaxy, in our own galaxy. We're going to talk now about what it means for the science that's already been done, the theorising, hypothesising that's already been done, and for the future. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Let's talk now about Professor Roy Kerr, his discovery 50 plus years ago now, and the relationship to Albert Einstein's equations on general relativity. Be bold, David, trust us, and take us through it.
Okay, so Einstein wrote down our theory of gravity as we now understand it, where it's no longer a force as we think of forces, but something about the curvature of space-time. And soon after Einstein had that theory back in 1915, a solution which describes non-rotating stars was found, the solution of Karl Schwarzschild. And for 40 years, that was the only solution that we had, because it's very difficult to solve the equations. And back then, people assumed the solution did have this property that you could make things, if things became so dense, then they would become black holes. But a lot of the astrophysicists of the day disregarded that as a possibility, because they knew that everything rotates. And they thought, well, if we add rotation, then that will probably stop this property, the event horizon, the surface of no return, where not even light can get out. That's the event horizon. So the astrophysicists of the day thought, well, that if you just add rotation, that's probably going to kill that, and so we don't have to worry about black holes as physical objects in the universe. So people were trying to find a solution, and it took over 40 years, and it was Roy Kerr this university, who at the time was a postdoc at the University of Texas in Austin, and so he worked out the solution, and that is Some people describe it as the most important exact solution of any theory in physics, just because there are these other theorems which tell you that if you are in empty space or close to empty space, then the solution is unique. And so it's got mass and it's got angular momentum. It's spinning and it can spin up to a certain maximum rate because nothing can go faster than the speed of light. And what we've learnt now, this black hole is certainly spinning. We can't put an exact number on the spin value, but we can say that it's between 50 and 94% of the maximum rate. So that's quite an amazing thing. The black hole in M87 we already knew was spinning at 90% of the maximum rate, plus or minus 10%. So it's spinning really fast. It's spinning in the same direction as the gas, plasma, whatever it is that is falling in. So we've learned that already from this image. And so it is certainly a massive vindication of Roy's solution. Roy's solution is really the basis of all the investigations. That they require complex codes called general relativistic magnetohydrodynamics to understand how the particles of the plasma interact with the black hole. And in fact, it's the spin energy of the black hole which interacts with the magnetic fields to drive many of the processes that we see. So basically, Roy Kerr's solution is the centerpiece on which whole fields of physics are built.
When you saw that image then, and were you able to, were scientists able to visually confirm his equations? What was it that was able to confirm his theory?
Well, his theory has been confirmed many, many times over the last couple of decades. It's not just that this one thing. His solution is the centerpiece of the modeling. If you read any of these papers, you know, they're discussing, well, let's assume a Kerr solution and in this Kerr-Schultz coordinate system, et cetera. So one could say the fact that this black hole is spinning between 50 and 94% of the maximum allowed by his solution, that if you tried to do it with a non-rotating black hole solution, it wouldn't work. I mean, that's one confirmation, but we're really well beyond just confirming. This is the centerpiece of whole new areas of science.
But it is, I guess, ability to visualize what has been done by hand by a mathematician, and I imagine it was by hand back in the day, right? And I wanted to ask
that. Yeah, it was pen and paper.
It's extraordinary.
That's why it was so difficult.
Yeah. As we said, Professor Kerr spoke to Kim Hill on Saturday, so do go back and have a listen to him speaking about his own experience with this. But can you explain to us what branch of mathematics was brought to bear? Was it straight algebra or well beyond that? And how long was the equation to tell the story that he told?
Well, it's general relativity, so that's physics, which uses the mathematics of differential geometry. And so it's what are known as partial differential equations that you have to solve. And there are that would get into a very technical discussion. Nowadays, you can put it on a computer and do it in, fraction of a second, but solve things algebraically. Back in the day, you couldn't, the fact that it took over 40 years. I mean, there are many interesting things about that discovery, because he announced it at this conference, and the conference had been called because people had just discovered quasars, and quasars are these active galactic nuclei which were abundant early on in the universe, when there was a lot of gas to be eaten up, and the magnetic fields around the black holes make magnetic funnels which chuck out particles. The most energetic phenomena since the Big Bang, really. And so Roy presented this solution. He was given 10 minutes as a postdoc at the end of the conference, and all of the astronomers, because they were all gathered to ask the question, well, what's going on here? Because it seems it can only be gravitational. Or nobody understood what could be the source of so much energy being given off. And Roy gave this talk, and people weren't paying much attention. They were talking to each other, and there was one aging general relativist in the audience, Achille Papapetrou, a Greek guy, and he got up and he admonished the audience and said, you really have to listen to this. This is so important, you know, over 40 years. And the ironic thing is that it turned out, people didn't realize then, but it turned out that this is exactly the mechanism which was which was powering the quasars, which the whole reason for the conference being called. So that's...
I probably asked the wrong question. My question might have been how many, you know, sheets of paper went in the rubbish bin before the equation was complete. But I was just trying to envisage his manual process and the branch of mathematics involved.
It's in the Turnbull. Well,
is it in the Turnbull Library?
Lots of sheets of rubbish went into the
A lot of work went into cracking this. Let's leave it at that.
Sorry?
I was going to say, a lot of work went into cracking this. Let's leave it at that, because I want to use this last precious time, David, to talk about its implications going forward. And space-time. Look, there's a question that's come in from one listener. I'll put it to you. When black holes move through their orbit, how does time work for that orbit? I.e., if time slows down hugely, the closer you are, does that affect its motion through space-time?
It's impossible to talk about time slowing down without saying which observer you're talking about. So that's one of these things about general relativity. When people say time slows down near a black hole, it means time slows down even if you're at a fixed distance, because we can make time slow down at any point by an arbitrary amount by giving you a speed relative to me close to the speed of light. So we do know that the effects of time delay, so we can these things are easy to calculate. We can go away, well, at least easy for those of us who know how to do it, and you can do it easily on a computer. It does, so the time dilation does affect things, and in particular, if you look at stars, which are nearby the supermassive black hole in the centre of our galaxy, then you can see the effects of time dilation on the light. So there's a gravitational redshift, so the light of certain stars becomes more redshifted, it changes its frequency as they get closer to the black hole, so that was observed 4 years ago. So we see these effects, and those effects already are things that we know and have worked out. And there's much more going forward in learning about the accretion disks and the part that black holes play in the ecology of the universe.
What are the main questions as they stand, and what is a wonderfully fast moving, you know, having taken all these years to achieve what the professor did, Professor Kerr did? It is also a very fast-moving area of science. And what are the main questions now?
Well, there are a huge number of questions, and I would say as far as accretion disks go, it's understanding the role that supermassive black holes play in the life cycle of galaxies. So you and I are made of star stuff, and those stars have often been formed because pressure waves, whether from supernova or from jets of material being flung out of the centers of galaxies, all of those processes, you could call that galactic ecology. And we know that there are black holes in the centers of all galaxies. The bigger the galaxy, the bigger the black hole in the center. And so this is, because we can see it up close, is going to tell us about a lot of processes that we can't really work out when we're just looking at ones which are very far away.
Let me indulge one more listener. If you can, please ask what the diameter of the collapsed star is at the centre of a black hole. I understand the idea there is singularity at the centre has lost favour.
It's, well, so Roy chatted a bit about this with Kim Hill, and the point is that it's not that the notion of a singularity is just a mathematical artifact. And if you look at it, all we can really say is that we know physics breaks down. So the way that Stephen Hawking put it, because his name is also attached to similar theories, is that general relativity predicts its own downfall. Now, because these things are called the singularity theorems, then people think about the singularity as being something that exists, but it's just a mathematical artifact. It's saying that something becomes infinite, and we know in physics that can't happen. And all we can really say is our theory breaks down. We know that there is a lot that we don't know. And many physicists assume that once we have a theory of quantum gravity, which we don't have, then we'll understand those questions. So there are powerful questions about fundamental physics, which are still to be understood. And what goes on inside a black hole, we don't know.
Isn't that great? Plenty left to wonder about and pursue.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much. University of Canterbury Professor of Physics, David Wiltshire. And do listen back to Kim's interview with Professor Roy Kerr if you're interested in this. It was last Saturday.